everyone. This is Dan Nexon, and you're listening to episode 33 of Whiskey and IR Theory, entitled, Status, You Just Met Us. This is the second and final episode from our live event at the British International Studies Association Annual Convention, which was held in Glasgow this summer, and therefore is sponsored by the Clydeside Distillery. If you want to know more about the Clydeside Distillery and its whiskey, you can look them up, you can follow the link in our program notes, or you can listen to the previous episode in which we have a representative from the distillery talking about how they make it and what's involved and what it tastes like. This episode is a whiskey optional roundtable featuring me, Patrick Jackson, and four guests. And you got to bear with me here because I know I'm going to screw up their names a bit, and I'm really sorry in advance, okay? Michelle Murray from Bard College, Ali Biljic from Loughborough University, Rohan Mukherjee from the London School of Economics, and Stephen Ward from the University of Cambridge. Now, since this is a live recording, the audio is erratic, and there's probably more filler than we typically have in an episode. But it's also a non-insane length, clocking in at around an hour. I hope you enjoy it as much as we enjoyed recording it. And when I say enjoyed recording it, I should let you know that at least some of the panel was, well, let's put it this way. We'd had already an hour and some drinking whiskey, so some of the panel might be a little bit inebriated. Whether that improves the quality of the session or makes it worse, who can say? That's a counterfactual we'll never know. I don't have anything to add to that by way of introduction, so without further ado, let's get to the roundtable.
I don't know where Patrick is, so I guess we're gonna get started on status, and I'm hoping that we have time to open this up, but like every good or bad panel, you know, time is not what we hope for. That was supposed to be funny and it trailed off and I'm sorry. So we're gonna do a whiskey optional, but everybody seems to be drinking whiskey, about status. I thought status was a really good topic for BISA because there's so many kind of diverse issues and subject areas that can get rolled into status, and also because it's kind of a hot topic in IR right now. My pathetic way, I ask people to introduce themselves. So we really got a terrific panel for this, a terrific group of people. So can we get a round of self-introductions?
Sure. Hi, everyone. My name is Rohan Mukherjee, and I teach at LSE.
I'm Michelle Murray. I teach at Bard College.
I'm Stephen Ward. I teach at Cambridge.
Hi, everybody. Ali Biljic. I'm from Loughborough University.
So the first question I have, and I should probably assign, I'm going to make it a toss-up, right? Which is, so what the hell is status? Dead silence. Pens writing. Steve, you look like you're...
Status is position in a social hierarchy, and I think that what one of the distinguishing elements of status is that status depends on recognition by other actors.
I guess my tweak on that is that I think status is a recognized identity in a social order. And so recognition is key to this, but it is not recognition of your capabilities, it's recognition of a role identity in a social order.
I think that maybe we're just talking about two different types of status, right? With the sort of the Wolf understanding of sort of role status and trait status, and I think those two things can be reconciled in a sense, which is sometimes it originates in capabilities, sometimes it originates in claims to an identity. And I think, at least when we think about sort of the work that I've done, thinking about great power identity or major power identity in Michelle's work, like claims to that are also claims to a certain kind of status in international politics.
There is no such a thing as status beyond the subject. It is one's pursuit of recognition and respect from the others.
So the next question was going to be, and you should think about this, you know, why are we talking about it? Like, why is it important? But I actually have a maybe a more straightforward question. Like, okay, how is it different from prestige? I always wanted to know this.
Do I have to go first?
No, you can go in any order you want. Grab the mic, fight for it.
So I'm sure the others will amend this. So prestige, at least Gilpinian prestige, is reputation for power. And I think status can be broader than that, right? So status can be based on other traits or membership in other kinds of clubs that are based on other kinds of characteristics than power.
I would agree with that.
You can have status without prestige, and you can have prestige without that status.
So really kind of distinct concepts. We shouldn't do that whole thing where we go status and prestige in our articles. We should keep them separated.
Go ahead. Yeah, no, I think, so yeah, I think the distinction, sort of the Gilpin distinction is helpful to a certain extent, which is, you know, other people have written about this as well, which is reputation for power can be solved in a way if other people just sort of, you provide them with more information about your power, right? But this aspect of recognition is central to status, right? So in a sense, I can keep investing in my prestige, I can keep hosting Olympics, I can keep doing things that enhance it in some way by showing that I provide more information to others about what I'm capable of. But it's only when they recognize my position in a hierarchy as being one that deserves eminence or that should bring about some amount of deference from others, that I think is status.
I guess there can be status prestige hierarchies. I think it is possible to talk about that there might be some states in the world that are considered as states which have lots of prestige and respected for that, but they may not have the material infrastructure to enforce their will and make that change in the world.
So why has this topic exploded in the last, like, I mean, because I remember when I was in grad school, there was stuff on status floating around, and, you know, the role of status and prestige in power transition theory and hegemony theories was something that people were kind of interested in, but it was not as central to the discussion as it is now. It certainly wasn't like a research program, which I think it's increasingly become. So what's going on?
I think the status literature kind of exploded in early 2000s, mid 2000s. And I think it's very much about, as you said earlier, regarding certain states, which I use this concept very, very deliberately, naughty boys, Russia, China, etc., who might be troublemakers. Will they be revisionists? Will they be pro-statisco powers? What are we going to do about that? So I think this explosion on status is very much, I think, US-centric and Eurocentric to a certain extent. And regarding what are we going to do about this new powers, I think that was the main push in that area regarding, you know, what is going to happen to the West, what's going to happen to the West leading international system. That pushed us very much. So we are part of that structure now.
Anybody else want to?
I mean, I think just talking about my own trajectory and how I became interested in this. So I went to graduate school at the University of Chicago, where John Mearsheimer figures realism, right? Alex Wendt called it the temple of realism when I first started. And I came into this trying to explain things that realists couldn't explain. And so I was looking at, I guess, behavior. So my big case is Imperial Germany, naval program, right, which you study as well, right? These are things that I think just can't be explained by rational realist theory. And there's a sense in which I think that it it emerged, at least for me, as a reaction to realism. I think that's probably a mistaken way of doing it. And then looking out at the world, you actually see a lot of states doing things that doesn't, that just doesn't make sense from this kind of narrow framework. And status has become a useful category to try to understand this other set of behavior.
So the research on status was always around, right? We called it rank, or we called it something else. When, you know, in the 70s, people like Bilarski and others were doing this stuff. And I think a lot of the focus then was on war, right? This relationship between rank and war, what makes countries more likely to fight wars and things like that. I think the end of the Cold War brought about this period of relative prosperity and peace for, you know, the unipolar moment or whatever we want to call that, where people started thinking about other things that might be driven by the same concerns, right? And so then you get a much broader panoply of dependent variables, right, that you can sort of explain using status, because the world is suddenly thinking about a lot of other things. There's peace building, there's economic interaction, there's climate negotiations. It's been applied in all these different ways. And I think that, you know, one also has to credit the sort of the Deborah Larson and Bill Wohlforth kind of push to reinvigorate that research agenda, thinking about order, thinking about institutions, but also just thinking about other effects than conflict in the role that status plays in international politics.
How does status, so I think about, when I think about like burgeoning areas of literature that I've sort of follow enough, there are status and hierarchy. And I've always been a little bit confused by the relationship between them. Like, I sometimes think it's, you know, actually it's just status all the way down. All hierarchies that are socially relevant are status hierarchies. Sometimes like, well, no, we're also talking about different kinds of stuff. I'm just not sure. Like, well, how should we think about the relationship between those two concepts? I mean, we already know that status has to do with hierarchies, but beyond that, you know, what are we talking about?
So I'll take a stab at this. So I think that status is a form of hierarchy, and I think the answer to this question depends on how you define hierarchy. The broadest definition of hierarchy, which is just sort of like vertical difference, so that could just be power hierarchies as well, and not have anything to do with recognition, right? So status wouldn't encompass hierarchy, but it would be a form of hierarchy. I find Aisha Zarikol and Janice Bailey Matern's sort of conceptualization of hierarchy pretty useful, right? And so most of the status literature is in that second, the sort of positional understanding of hierarchy. So it's part of the hierarchy research program, but I don't think that it's coterminous with it.
Yeah, a lot of the sort of early social psychology stuff, right, that people draw on, Steve's written about this, Deborah Larson's written about it, and so on, a lot of it was based on groups of equal rank. So the in-group, out-group phenomenon that people found, which was you're closer to people within your own group, however you define that, whether it's wearing blue shirts or red shirts or whatever, versus people who are wearing the other color of shirt, that was kind of the affinity kind of literature, right, in social psychology. And then when people started introducing rank differentials in those experiments, you started to see a lot of different behaviors, a range of behaviors, right, at sort of individual group levels and so on, that people can engage in different strategies to be recognized as higher status. So once rank, to me, signals a sort of a social hierarchy that we can conceptualize, I think, in very different ways. And there's sort of the sort of contractual hierarchy of international order, and then there's a sort of the Zarikol and Puglio kind of everything is hierarchy, we're just kind of born into it in some ways, approach to international order. Either, whichever way you do it, I think as long as you have groups that identify on some axis and can be differentiated and are unequal in that dimension of that makes that hierarchy tick, you can have status politics in some sense.
Yeah, so it sounds a little bit to me like one of the arguments, at least, for why status has become prevalent in, you know, again, like top journals, is essentially status anxiety, right? It's that the people who live in the places who publish in those journals are worried about the status of the countries that they live in and the status of the order in terms of the way it allocates status. But which would imply then that if you were working in other parts of the world where maybe status would have already been baked into the discussion. I don't know. I want to kind of push you on this question of Eurocentrism and this question of, how that might be affecting this discussion.
Because I'm also new. I'm new in status literature, and my background is postcolonial analysis and gender hierarchies in world politics. So when I start reading the status literature, one of the things that struck me a lot, and it's disturbed me when I was reading it, is that we created this concept, status hierarchy, different types of status hierarchies, etc., and then we forget that they are actually very Eurocentric, West-centric, and we've forgotten that they are simplifying analytical tools, and we start to think that, I think, how complex world politics work. However, if you, in the moment that you go outside so-called established Western powers, and you look at how other states from global south in different political sides, not only state elite, but also media, popular culture, literature, different sides, this kind of where this country is in relation to West, in relation to outside the West, in the world, has been going on for a long time. And if in the moment that we open the discussion to this kind of debates in different parts of the world and beyond the state elite level practices and discourses, we see an immense pluralism regarding where that state, where that country, where that culture, where that history actually stands in the world. So this is one of the things that I've been using now and studying and using status in a different way. So I look at particular political sites and how certain subject is being produced in that particular political site vis-a-vis other actors in the world regarding particular status.
I'm going to be difficult here for a second. Can you give me a concrete example, like a proper noun version of the argument?
Okay. So we have been talking about, in status-seeking literature, let's say, we have been talking about Turkey as a rising actor for a long time, status-seeker, one of the middle powers, right? If you look at historically, late Ottoman era, early Republic, 1960s, 70s, if you actually look at, if we historicize political discourse in Turkey, you can easily see these anxieties regarding where Turkey has been standing vis-a-vis the West, vis-a-vis the Middle East, Africa, been there all the time. These concerns were there all the time. It is just that, but the status literature, because focusing on particular actors, rising great powers, etc., and they are very much also presentism in status literature. There is not so much historicization of this where these hierarchies are coming from. We don't really see that. So that would be my concrete, probably, example.
I mean, what do you guys think about this criticism? I'm going to just pretend it's directed at you.
I mean, I think that the field, right, has tended to look at rising powers, right, and think about status with rising powers. But in my framework, for example, there's no, and I do that too, right? I look at rising powers. But there's no reason why it has to, right, conceptually. So there seems to be, there's a some sort of conceptual question. So is status as a category or concept Eurocentric, or is how the field has developed its questions Eurocentric? I think those are two different things.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think, right, Rising Powers is in the title of my book, but does not imply that I think that revisionism or status is restricted to rising powers, right? I think that, at least in my case, the focus on rising powers emerged out of an interest in great power war, right? It was sort of like, you know, my first political science professor was a realist, and my dissertation advisor was also a realist, and I had another realist on the dissertation committee. They weren't all realists because Dan was there too. But it's not a sort of a sense that status concerns don't matter for anyone else. It was just a focus on the particular puzzle drove me to look at rising great powers. I would also note that there's increasing work on small state status seeking, right? And middle powers, although I think that's a category that I find difficult to understand.
I would just take a slightly different position here, which is, I think, if you think about Cold War history, which is really where I came to this from in some sense, the position of the Global South is permeated with status inequality, right? This is what they think about constantly with regard to not just the West, but also the Soviet Union. And so I think in some sense, being the third, the other, in that setup, I think leads to a certain obsession with rank and positionality among countries, and I'm not saying that this is in any way specific to them, but one can also historicize that, right? Because the way I think about it is about the politics of exclusion and inclusion and who gets to set global rules, right? Or who has the privileges, global rulemaking privileges, as we might call them, right? And so in some sense, the English school got it right a long time ago when we talked about the standard of civilization. Like, my entire book could have been about the standard of civilization if I had just written it differently, right? Which is, the US feels like, as a rising power, it has to adhere to a certain European standard in the 19th century. The Japanese feel the same way in the interwar period. The Indians feel the same way in the Cold War, although they rejected, they inverted in some ways because decoloniality and decolonization is now much more powerful as an idea, as an organizing idea for international order. And we see that now in how China talks about the international order as well, right? So in some sense, this has been around, and it permeates. So it is presentist, but I think it's possible to historicize that.
It is definitely possible to historicize. So it's happening right now. I think that's and there are some people in this grand roundtable actually doing this kind of work. So thank you for that. So my kind of response to that: why do we have the concept called status seeker for particular states, and we repeatedly study those states as status seeker, and these states are Russia, China. Why don't we study United States as status seeker, or United Kingdom, France? So we are part of this epistemological discourse that are creating the status hierarchies within the discipline, and then feed into politics. So this is the political side as well, what we are doing.
Just to say that I think there is work being done on that. I mean, I think Josh Friedman's work, for example, on Britain, shows the impact it's a Western actor actually that's obsessed with status, right? Steve's work on Spain recently on decline, which is actually another thing that we don't think about enough, right? Which is status loss, yeah. Right? The status losers and how they are responding. I think that his new work is great on that. So I think it's being done. I think it's just it's a question of the field evolving in some sense and taking on these new concerns. But you're right. Like, I think our traditional concern has been rising powers. I would just define that broadly and think of it in a more historical sense. For me, the US as a rising power is critical in this whole enterprise because we find that there are recognizable patterns in how these states behave over time.
I agree with you, Rohan. As you said, when it comes to great powers, when it comes to Western states, we only discuss status when it comes to the decline, when it comes to losing that status or what's going to happen next. But this decline and rise up again is historically been part of Turkey, Iran, Egypt, is part of that narrative for a long, India, part of that narrative for a long time. But when it comes to only Western powers, we are talking about decline, what's going to happen next. So I think this is one of the problems of the literature, but it is evolving, as you said, I agree.
I mean, but does it, I mean, in a really kind of crude way, I would think it would matter that states that have hoarded a lot of opportunities and perquisites are losing material capabilities relative to, you know, by which they have enforced those perquisites, relative to states who have faced, states, leaders, peoples, communities that have faced exclusion. I mean, this is a kind of interesting process because there's that piece that Rebecca and Aisha did in I.O., right, about, about the homology between status loss of states and of individuals within states, that it's a European-centric thing. But so I think that, you know, I would think that is a really significant development. But it is interesting that the language, there is something interesting about the way that the language makes certain presuppositions about the dynamics. That was supposed to be a question, and people wanted to get in, and then I screwed it up, so. I mean, is that wrong? I don't know.
I mean, I think it depends on what role you think recognition plays and what that means, right? So if you're recognized to have status, and that's finished once you're recognized and you have it, then yeah. But if that's always an ongoing process, then even the established powers who have status have to continue to perform their status in order to have it, right? You can't it's not just something you possess, it's something you do. And so why we don't look at that, I think, is a question, right? Why we talk about, you know, China as a status seeker, Turkey, Brazil as status seekers, and not the United States as a status seeker. As you said, I think that's a political question. But it doesn't strike me conceptually that our notion of status necessarily precludes us as understanding the United States, for example, as a status seeker.
You made that claim. Yeah.
I mean, I would just add that, like, that I think this has been mentioned, that there is an increasing amount of work on the U.S., for instance, as both historically, like Rohan's work about the U.S. In the first half of the 19th century. I've written about the U.S. in the second half of the 19th century, and so have you. And like Ahsan Butt in Security Studies a couple of years ago about the United States, about the Iraq War as basically status-inflected policy, right? So there, and outside the, John Glazer at Cato writes about the U.S. as status-obsessed, right? So this is not absent.
Mm-hmm. Rohan, do you have any?
Just to say that I think it's always been hiding in plain sight, right? Great power politics is status politics to me, which is that, why do you care about these little bits of territory that really don't have much strategic value? It's because they hold meaning in other ways, right? It's status, it's your position in a global hierarchy. It's also partly, there are maybe reputational concerns, you know, other people have worked on that as well. But to me, that makes much more sense as a sort of universal thing that we all should kind of recognize in the politics of all states. And we do. I do agree, though, that I think the way the literature has gone, and you know, we can certainly remedy that, and is being remedied, has been in a particular direction.
I wonder if there isn't a more, if this problem doesn't, if there isn't a bigger problem analytically, and I don't really know quite how to phrase this, but I would say, maybe I could put it this way. When I took a network theory course, which turned out to be a lot of theory and no methodology, which was not what I was looking for, but it turned out to be awesome. Like, it informed a lot of what I did. One of the things we talked about, we spent a lot of time actually talking about status hierarchies, right? And, you know, read the famous Chickens article. Essentially, the chickens have no memory, and yet they produce hierarchies of pecking orders by who backs down and who doesn't back down. And that you can take the same chickens, plop them down in a different coop, you'll get a pecking order. The structure will be similar, but the players will be very different, who's where, right? And this is supposed to then talk about not just the universality of status hierarchies among vertebrates, at least, and probably among invertebrates as well, but the ways in which you don't need a kind of top-down theory of hierarchy to understand the emergence of hierarchy. Now, the reason I raise this is that in that discussion, one of the things that kept on coming up was the idea that if you think about status hierarchy, if you think about the actual like ladder of status, and you think about where people are positioned on it, there are reasons to think that if you're at the very top or at the very bottom, you have very different kinds of status concerns than if you're in the middle. You know, in essence, that, for example, you can be completely indifferent to struggles at levels below you that don't affect your position. And that's a story, it's a little bit of an illustration, but that leads me to think there's something that might be analytically problematic about studying that top sphere and then the stigmatized states, the bottom sphere, that they may not, the behavior and the discourses and the rhetoric might be different in substantive ways because of their social position. Is that at all true?
Well, that's a big question. I think my take on that is that, what hierarchy? Mm. Who is on the top? Who is in the middle? Mm. Who's in the bottom? Who says that? According to whom? Is there a convention somewhere we are not aware about, you know, decides who is on the top, who's in the middle, who decides this hierarchy? Is it possible to join that club? Do you sign a contract to join that? Do you actually, what all this status literature I've been thinking so far, why don't we get even once, okay, this state status ambitions actually accommodated, accepted to the higher club, and then status seeking ended. Why don't we ever get this?
Yeah, I mean, Steve.
So I think my take is, again, these are analytical tools, simplifying analytical tools. In the moment that we go to that complexity, I know Steve's accommodation theory and lack of accommodation is maybe useful here, is that we see a kind of perceptions in the local level regarding where that country stands regarding as to international hierarchies. So country access status in the world is different for United States and France and United Kingdom and for the people in that country and more state elite in that country and the media in that country. So it is, we are looking at a really complex politics here that I wouldn't go that kind of framework.
Yeah, I guess I thought the reason I kind of genuflected literally towards Steve is that one of your arguments is that the assumption that runs through a lot of the status literature is that that states that have achieved membership in the club are happy and peaceful, and that right. that's actually completely right. wrong. Do you want to?
Yeah. I guess the short version. Yeah, I mean, I think some of this has been said. So having status doesn't necessarily mean that you have to stop trying to perform it to maintain it. And so to the extent, for instance, that one has been accepted into the Great Power Club, whatever that means, one still has to continue to do the things that great powers do. And sometimes that can involve really competitive, disruptive, violent behaviors, right? And so this conflicts with prominent arguments that accommodation through the sort of granting of special rights and institutions or nice rhetoric, right, can make states basically sort of not submissive, but peace more peaceful, right? I think it depends on how the status, the particular status hierarchy or status order is constituted, in the sense that we need to know what kinds of dimensions of comparison are valuable. So Paul Roran has a nice piece recently in International Security on different status orders related to the fate of Russia's status as a result of, I think it's actually 2014, not 2022, so the annexation of Crimea.
Yeah, I mean, so I have a slightly different view on this because I do think that accommodation matters, but I think we have to be clear what we're talking about, right? So Bill Thompson has this distinction between big S status and small S status, right? And I think big S status is about the inclusion in certain clubs, right? And he's talking about sort of the club, which is the great power club, right? But then within that club and within all clubs, there is also more fine-grained small S status distinctions about protocol, procedure, who gets to sit where. You see this all the time in conferences, right? Like academic conferences, but also international diplomatic conferences. I remember studying the Washington conference in 1921, and the French are really upset because they don't get to sit at the head of the table with the Japanese and the British and the Americans. And so on the second day, a low-ranking British delegate has to move so that the head French delegate can sit at the, you know, closer up, right? And you see this with France actually consistent in some sense. So again, there's more work to be done, I think, on French status seeking as well.
Seems kind of like low-hanging fruit.
Right. But all that to say that I think there are different forms of status that we're talking about, and I think inclusion can have powerful effects. I don't want to say pacifying effects, but I think it does bring about a certain ownership or investiture in the enterprise that we are calling the order, as it were, and therefore you are more willing to then sort of act, I guess, in a way to defend it or improve it in directions that are perhaps benefiting a larger subset of the international order versus, and the counterfactual here is a lack of accommodation, right, which is, I think, where Steve's work and Michelle's and my own shows that, you know, the lack of accommodation really does screw things up in a big way, right? So what remains, I think, is to show then when you're in the club, do you just, in a sense, then start acting out those norms, or do you sort of have some different agenda within that to bring down the club from within. I mean, I think that that is more of an empirical question, which gets to this idea of who's hierarchy, what hierarchy. I think those are empirical questions. I think the more interesting theoretical question that a lot of people are asking is, what are the effects of status denial or conferral, right? So it can be any hierarchy. We can specify that empirically, but in theory, how does that affect the behavior of the subjects that are denied or conferred, right?
So I would just very quickly note that I think that big S and small s status bleed into each other in ways that make it very hard to separate them. So for instance, like in a lot of ways, Japan is included in the Great Power Club in the 1920s, right? It's a permanent member of the League of Nations Council, right? It's just that there's all these little sort of things that make it seem like that membership is not certain or complete, right? But how we distinguish, right, in Rohan's, right, fairness versus inclusion, sometimes those things bleed together in ways that are analytically really difficult.
Sure.
Michelle, do you?
I don't want it.
I think whose hierarchy for whom are not empirical questions. I think they are very important conceptual questions, because if we do not make this conceptual, if we do not answer those conceptual questions right, it will significantly affect what kind of hierarchies and how we study hierarchies and whose hierarchies we are studying. So it is a bit more, I think, it's a strong, very important conceptual question.
Please? I know you have lots of really cool things to say about all of this.
I mean, I think one of the underexplored areas of this is why established powers, in whatever sense you want to sort of think about that, can't just give recognition to other states, right? It hurts somehow to do that, right? Why couldn't Britain just recognize? This is a question I get all the time. Just recognize them, right? Yeah, that would be really easy, right? Well, just recognize China. But the U.S. can't do that for some reason, right? It comes at a cost. And I don't know what the answer to that is, but I think that's a piece of the accommodation story, is why it's so hard for states that have status to recognize newcomers to the club.
I think for me, again, the question is, why do we consider U.S. as an established power and China not an established power? Why is the newcomer? Newcomer to what? So these are the exact epistemological assumptions that we are making in status literature. We are starting from the assumption that there is a West-led liberal international order, there are established powers there, and there are newcomers. That is the start for me. That's the start of questioning.
I mean, the one thing I would add to that is, if you look at the Chinese writing on status, it is precisely that assumption that they're making, right? That there is a Western power that denies them the recognition that they seek. So yes, I mean, I think there is a way in which, or a strand in which sort of Chinese thinkers think of China as a great power, but most of the time actually it's the have not power. The sort of, the way E.H. Carr talks about Italy, right? Italy is a have not power before the First World War. So I think, again, empirically countries do feel that way, right? So how do we then reconcile this with the way we study it, that perhaps wants to be more emancipatory in some way, right? Mm-hmm. I don't know the answer to that, but I do think there is a distinction there, yeah.
No, go ahead.
I think it is important to make a separation here. States are relational social actors, after all, and they are all interacting in a certain dominant system. I agree with that. And China is, of course, it's not, if you look at the state level discourse, you can see that kind of interaction. But I think my question is, why are we making these assumptions as IR scholars? So it is a bit more than empirics.
I mean, I would think that we're just kind of repeating back the policy. I would think that what's happening is what IR scholars in the global north always do, which is repeat back the policy discourse and think about it analytically. But I mean, this is the way that when I look at these issues, because I'm interested in hierarchy, I do see Brazilian diplomats, I do see Turkish diplomats, I do see Chinese diplomats talk this way. Right, I mean, about being emerging. I mean, it was the whole BRICS discourse, right? It's all a discourse of emergence, right? Now we have emerging multipolarity, which you can't escape in Washington. Mm-hmm. so it seems to me that there is something about the way in which there's maybe it's a reproduction of a hegemonic project, and that's interesting, but I think that is sort of how the diplomatic actors are talking about things, which is, you know, doesn't mean we shouldn't critique it.
I believe Vincent Poilievre's work practice dimension of status and status politics is very insightful. I think one of the most important works have been produced in this particular discipline. In that particular piece, he argues that it is not only state actors invest in it, the game is also invested in them. They are part of the game, they perform it, they practice it. And China, Turkey, Brazil, they are part of the game. I think it is. I think it also relates to the question, and it has been discussed in the status literature as well, how the states are contributing to the reconstruction of the hierarchies that humiliated them in the first place. I think this is very important, and I think Zarakol's work you mentioned earlier, humiliation, shame, how they internalize Japan, Russia, Turkey cases, there are very important and good works on that, and that's important.
I want to make sure we don't miss a dimension before I kind of open this up, which is really something that I think is central to your work, which is the idea that there are behaviors in international politics that are often coded as being, you know, realist behaviors that are really better explained as performances of status. Because it's, you know, obviously realism is the easy target. We all like to beat up on the realists, blah, blah, blah. But there is broadly, at least within inside the Beltway discourse, there is this kind of like material power that undergirds a lot of stuff. And this quest to make the capabilities an objective, measurable thing that is not, rather, and move away from the idea that these are status performances. So I don't want to lose that. Can we sort of maybe open up a little bit the idea that what it means if we start thinking about things that we normally think about as something else, as being in some way or another about status?
That was directed to you.
Things like material power?
Things like, you know, I mean, like one of the obvious ones is like battleships and dreadnoughts.
I mean, so my argument is, right, that status is really about identity and it has to be performed. And there's a script out there, right, that says this is what a great power does. They get to sit at certain tables and have a certain kind of voice in terms of leadership. They acquire certain kinds of capabilities because these are the things that are symbolic of this really elite status. They occupy hierarchical positions vis-a-vis lesser states. And so there's always a materiality to it because they have to do these things, right? You have to walk and talk and look like a great power in order to have status. I think the grave mistake when we reduce that simply to, let's say, the realist understanding of the world, because it's about material power, we misunderstand fundamentally what conflict is about, which means then we don't know how to understand what's going on. We don't know how to find solutions. We can't be good policymakers if we're missing the point of what these things are. And so, you know, on the one hand, I think it's easy to beat up on the realists, but they do have this dominant position that anything about military power is about realism, and it's not, right? It depends on the argument you make and how well that argument explains things that go on in the world. And so I actually think the stakes are really high. And like Rohan said, I think great power competition or great power politics is status politics, right? That is what it's about in its full array of manifestations.
If I may, so the area that I think about a lot is nuclear weapons as well. And I think there the standard argument is, states do that, build nuclear weapons for security reasons, right? But I think there's enough work to show that there may be conditions under which they make you much less secure by painting a target on your back if you have an adversary, or by making the subject of US sanctions, US rollback efforts, and so on. And yet states try to do it. And so I think status can really help us make sense of that rather counterintuitive thing if we include it as an explanation. Again, this as you were talking about in your previous session, right? Like, it's not ideas or institutions, it's not status or materiality. I think both these things often work together. And you know, so if states, there's also no point at which states feel perfectly secure. They continue performing security. They also continue performing status in some ways, right? So I think states, it's okay to admit that states value multiple things, and are trading off between them at different points. I think that's not necessarily controversial. The one other thing I would say is like, I really like the conclusion to, I think, is it like Johnston's like cultural realism, where he says, look, like the thing I've said is observationally equivalent to realism, but why the heck should we actually privilege realism, right? Why is that our prior? And I think that's a really good response to the sort of hegemonic discourse of realism in some sense, which is, why do we assume that everything is driven by security and survival, right? There may be other things that matter in the world, and the world really changes when we look at it in that way. I think that's what the best of the literature really shows, that in some ways.
Yeah, so I'll just say, I guess, two and a half things. The half is that I co-sign Rohan's, you know, why should we privilege realism thing. We all do that because we have to, but.
But do we have to? I mean, we're trying.
Well, it depends what journal you want to publish in, right?
It's realist. Yeah. There are more critical, to use the term, journals out there now.
Right? Yeah. I think it depends on what kind of puzzle you're working with. Mm-hmm. So if you want to talk about conflict and you want to publish in IS or security studies, right? I mean, so two things, right? So one is that I think that status stories imply that conflict is more pervasive and a harder problem to solve than security stories do. So that's one of the reasons why this is really matters. And the second sort of related thing, I'm very, very reluctant to bring this up because I don't think we want to go here, but so Mearsheimer's Mearsheimer's story about the Russia-Ukraine war, I think it's really a status story. It's very much it contradicts offensive realism, right? It's really a status story. So that's an episode of conflict that he's having a hard time explaining and reaching for things that are actually status-related concepts because the security-related concepts are not working.
Wait, you're not saying that it's puzzling when states power maximize if your theory is that states power maximize?
I mean,
what you're really saying is that, you know, he's explaining this in terms of status, face, Russian aspirations to have certain kinds of perquisites with being a recognized great power that are based on, you know, as John Kerry would say, atavistic 19th century. I always bring this up. I love that quotation because Kerry says that what's so 19th century and out of date about that is invading another country on trumped up charges. It's just like, yeah, you didn't, even if you didn't support the Iraq war, where are you speaking from?
Yeah. Right, no, so Alex Lenoshkin makes this point in a piece that came out, I think, 2020, right, the story about NATO enlargement doesn't make any sense from the perspective of offensive realism because, right, NATO, so if NATO hadn't enlarged, so that's when you would have expected Russian aggression, right? Because there's a power vacuum, Russia can go for continental hegemony, right? That's not the argument Mearsheimer makes.
Oh, you were reaching, yeah. Sorry.
The thing about realism is that they lay claim to a dependent variable, right? If a state is power maximizing, then they explain it, right? That is the argument, right? Oh, it's the default assumption that they make, and I think that others attribute to them. I did it for a long time, right? You twisted my own argument to sort of always be thinking, like, what is John Mearsheimer gonna say about this?
We don't care.
Right,
but
that was a
care.
Tough lesson.
Like, that's the problem. This is a status issue, right? Like why the heck do we talk about? Well, because, you know.
But they're looking at a phenomenon in the world and saying, we own that phenomenon. If this is happening, then we've explained it. Yeah. And they don't, right?
Yeah, this is what Hendrik used to always say in seminars, is like, the fact that you see conflict does not mean that realism is true. Realism is an explanation for that conflict. We have the same issue with the Power Politics book, where it's even worse, right? If you start talking about real politics, well, you must be a realist. And I think that's been actually extremely harmful, not so much because the realists have done, you know, we don't like realism, but because it's deterred people from engaging in certain kinds of questions in a way that is not only engaging those questions, but engaging with the arguments about those questions, right? So.
No.
Just an interesting example for me, because I've been working on this, regarding Turkey's confrontation with the United States in northern Syria.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, you can look at, I mean, as a realist, you might say that this is a great power competition. One is regional power trying to impose its own power in Syria, and United States being challenged, and then there's a confrontation in this military alliance, actually. But if you look at the media and the state elite discourse in Turkey, you see that, why are we being treated this way by United States as an ally, we are not the sick man of Europe anymore. So it is not just about that conflict. It is about the way that being treated, the way that they get get recognition and get respect for their interest that they define. So it is not just materiality, and it is very much historically loaded.
Well, I mean, I could go on my rant about how it's all materiality because ideas are material, and this whole distinction is stupid. You know, I think, I wonder if some of the thing that's going on here is that if you're an outsider to a discourse about status and prestige and about, I just did that, but if you're an outsider to narratives and discourses about where you stand in the world, about why you have certain kinds of perquisites and whatever, they always look ridiculous, right? So if you're inside the United States, you know, exceptionalism is just part of the atmosphere, right? And you don't really think about, is this absurd or not, right? But you look at like Turkey's neo-Ottomanism, you're like, well, that's really nuts, right? And that, but that isn't some of what's going on in some of these discussions. Is the difference that being an outsider versus an insider to discourses of why you should take us seriously? Do you know what I mean? I don't know. Do you want?
Oh, I would just say, like, in the contemporary discourse, whenever I hear the term primacy, it is about that, right? I mean, you are actually harming your primacy in many ways by overextending yourself in different ways or creating new conflicts, taking on new adversaries and so on, you know, Iran, and you can name them, right? But this addiction to primacy, this desire to maintain primacy, at least in Asia, Indo-Pacific, whatever we're calling it today, is ultimately, you could argue, there's a way to argue that it's ideological, but I think it's also just status driven, which is there is a desire in the United States, and it's among its elites, let's say, but maybe even among the population. I haven't seen the polling on this or anything, but to be recognized as the preeminent power in Asia that's holding everything down, right? When in fact, if you talk to a lot of Asian countries, the US perhaps historically has been the greatest source of instability in their region, right? And that's actually how a lot of countries see it.
No. The U.S. was protecting stability.
It was protecting stability, yes. But yeah, so I think primacy is ultimately about status.
Yeah, I mean, I actually wonder, and I do want to open this up, but I wonder if the psychological dimension isn't overlooked, because I think that, you know, we talk about the critique, I get a little sick of the blob discourse, but there is a Washington consensus around foreign policy, which is being nibbled away at the margins, and unfortunately I don't think it's being nibbled away in the right way, but nonetheless, and I think that part of the experience of cycling in and out of government and being a deputy assistant secretary or a assistant secretary or being an ambassador is that you like the deference and the prestige that comes from being a representative of the United States. And so that at some level there's a very kind of personal dimension to this, which is at the leadership level as well, you know, that you enjoy having high status in the hierarchies you're dealing with. And part of the reason you maybe support policies that are self-undermining is because you want to have that, those perks, those personal perks continue. I don't know. I mean, all right, I want to open this up because, like, we haven't talked much about gender, and then there's a lot of other stuff, and I know that status is one of those issues. The reason we chose it is because everybody's got something to say about it, because it potentially unites a whole bunch of different literatures. So any thoughts, comments, contributions, utterances from you all out there? We have a mic and everything. Oh.
So I want to go back to the
status. Okay, in every single way that you know all the panelists use it, I think most of us can follow the meaning that you're getting at. However, you also use it in a lot of different ways. And there seems to be both an explanatory component to this, a normative component to this. If you want to kind of go back to some of the critical theory stuff from earlier today, there's explanatory element to this. I'm going to use the distinction between traditional, as opposed to call the traditional versus critical theory approach to framing it. You know, I'm hearing sort of all of this. And so at the end of it, I'm left wondering, well, all I can really gather here is that when you're referring to status, you're actually referring to something else that gives the agent in question a particular form of positionality. Well, what is that other thing in question? Because otherwise you don't have a status. So you know when you're talking about what are the various criteria, that's what you that's the question. I think you're right. That's the question, right? If you're going to explain status, if you're going to use it in any kind of meaningful way, I think there has to be something that gives you a guide as to what actually are we judging this against. Why is this agent somehow higher up than this other one? Why is it that we can talk about these people as not talking about status when clearly they're doing it all the freaking time? I mean, I say talks about, So what is this other stuff? What are these unspoken assumptions that are being deployed in order to give the concept of status its currency? Because I haven't heard anybody actually articulate what those assumptions are, and that's what I'm curious about personally.
Easy question.
Yeah. So. I think that the reason that you haven't heard a good answer to that question is because there isn't one. So there are some people who will make strong claims about concrete kinds of factors and characteristics that yield status. Larson and Shevchenko and Renshon make this sort of claim about military power and about conflict behavior and about success and failure in war, right? But I think that so most of us, and I think probably all of us up here, would be really hesitant to give you any single answer that is not time and space variant about what kinds of factors yield status, or about what dimensions of comparison are valued, or put another way, right? What constitutes social capital in different kinds of fields, right? These are sort of different vocabularies to talk about the same thing. I think you're right that there hasn't been enough work on this, right? How do species of social capital vary and evolve across time and space? There's been very little work on this because the attention has mostly been on status as an independent variable, right? Status concerns, right? And so you'll make a claim about how a state, there's evidence that a state is under-recognized or status anxious or a status seeker, and then try to link that to a behavior, right? And I think that there is some work that's kind of at the leading edge of this particular research program that is kind of about trying to unpack what the fields are and what the species of social capital are and how they evolve, but that hasn't been the focus. And again, for reasons that others can get into. I'll mention one other thing, which is that I think that there is other work. Paul Beaumont at NUPE is the person that I'm most familiar with who's doing this kind of work. That's mostly interested in status discourses, right? So what are the effects of the deployment of claims about different kinds of status in domestic politics, and what are their implications for foreign policy? And I would say that probably depends less on sort of specifying exactly what are the markers of status, and is more about a species of discourse. It's a very long way of saying I don't know.
Okay. Very shortly. It is not only there is no status beyond the subject, there is no state prediscursively either, but there is only statecraft. So what we call status seeking, but I don't use that concept anymore, but status performances, at state level, media, popular culture, etc., is one of the ways of reproducing the state every day. So that's why it is quite impossible to give a universal timeless criteria of what it means to get that particular of whatever status that is. It keeps changing and changing. So this is more of an empirical question, at least from my point of view. I 100% agree. I think it is very useful in this way. It allows us to explore alternative, different, pluralist ways of statecraft in world politics and status performances in the world. It is very useful. I thanks for raising that. I agree.
I would just say that I don't think there is a lack of a definition. I think that it's just like a question of empirical specifications. It's the same as national interest or security. Like, yeah. Security for what? National interest for whom, right? I mean, if we were to go all the way, then it's like status all the way down or security all the way down. I mean, different states have different conceptions of the good life or of what constitutes their security. And so it varies by time and space. And that's the same for status, right? So I think that the seeking of deference from significant others, right? Yeah. Is really what we're talking about here. Who those significant others are, maybe the West, it may be your region, it may be other democracies, and all of those things may be happening simultaneously as well, right? So it's complex. That doesn't mean it's not defined. That's all I would say.
Yeah, and I would just say it's about fundamentally about social relations, right? So that is also a continuity, right? Is how social relations lead to this type of deference on the part of actors.
I can edit out the silences. So, I'm sure that, you know, like, one of the things that we encourage, and that's why we have alcohol, is some amount of half-bakedness, right? It's okay to kind of be like, I got something, but I don't really know how to express it. So if you have any thoughts that you want to share about status that could prompt something.
Yeah. I think this conversation is really abstract about status, and that we're starting to get towards the empirics of status. It's a moving target, is sort of the reconnaissance is politically significant in an international society. Can you make a distinction between status and between states and status in other social fields? It seems that there's something special between states that may be most empirically important here.
Can you say that again? But distinguish between states and status? Okay, so.
Did you?
No.
So I mean, the example that I use when I'm teaching about this or trying to fit 30 minutes into 12 minutes, right? So I care about the San Jose Sharks. I'm a big hockey fan.
What? Why?
I'm a big hockey fan. I'm also a big baseball fan. I cared about the Oakland A's, but no more. Because they're moving to Vegas. So why do I care about how the Sharks do, right? I mean, like, I can go to a game, it's a great time, have a couple beers, hockey's a wonderful sport to watch live. Why do I care that they win? Why does it matter how the game ends? The game looks broadly the same regardless. Why do I care that they make the playoffs? Why do I care that they... That they do well in the playoffs, or one day maybe win a Stanley Cup, right? And I think that has to do with social identity and my sort of emotional and psychological commitment in in the group, right? And I mean, I think that is similar to. So I would say, right, that not everyone, but some people feel the same way about states, right? That when you're watching the Olympics, or when you're reading the news and you're American and you're sort of reading about China or something like that, or Russia, right? You care about rank and deference, and it has nothing to do with security, and it has nothing to do with prosperity, because these rank differences don't really map onto those kinds of material consequences, right? And I think what Dan was suggesting about elites, right? That's a claim that's actually been made for decades in the status literature, that one of the things that happens is that leaders identify with states, right? And they care about the state status for reasons that have to do with social psychology, reasons that have to do with their own kind of the sort of psychic and personal benefits that they derive from occupying high status positions. In a way that is somewhat analogous to the way that we care about other kinds of groups and the status that they occupy in other kinds of social orders.
Okay, this is more of a whiskey talking, so it might be edited out later on. IR is a horrible, horrible, horrible discipline. It's a pirate discipline. It's constantly hijacked. It's constantly hijacked, steals concepts from other disciplines and appropriate them and ruin them. Status is one of them. Ontological security is another one. They constantly bring these concepts from sociology, from social psychology, from psychology, and then try to use them in international politics context and apply them to the states. And this is exactly related to why we are having this kind of discussions, debate today, because the way that the concept of status is being was conceptualized and used in sociology and social psychology really does not correspond to the political society that we are looking at today. That's why we are, I think.
Well, yeah, my glass was empty. I needed an excuse to come up and get some more whiskey, because I don't actually work on status. So, but it occurs to me, just sort of going off this particular comment, right? So, status is a way of prettying up what we're really concerned about here, which is domination, right? Great power status means I get to use force with impunity. And it's okay for me to use force with impunity. You want to talk social psychologically, I get to dominate you and it's okay because I'm better than you are, right? So there's an appeal, I mean, to San Jose Sharks, right? What is it about sports that creates that kind of emotive investment? Part of it is I get to watch my guys beat up on your guys and like dominate them, right? Especially hockey, which is like entirely about actually physically beating up on guys. At least baseball has some finesse. But and that was fighting words specifically, yeah, right? We'll talk later. But again, I guess I wonder, when this whole discussion that I've been listening to about status, I wonder whether this isn't just kind of a polite way of talking about what Weber would have called legitimate domination. I mean, this is about dominating, and status is just kind of a analytically cleaned up way of talking about throwing our weight around and being able to dominate things, particularly when you're talking to your question about states in particular, particularly when you're talking about international politics, which has generally been coded as this like anarchic realm of combat. Right? So status in that circumstance, it just seems to me that what we're really talking about here is domination.
Just a quick response to that, if I may. No, I think. First of all, I don't understand all these American jokes and et cetera. So sorry if I misunderstood anything. The analogies, whatever, baseball, et cetera. I don't get it. But no, it's not about domination, it's about recognition. It is not about domination. What about humanitarian status, for example? It's not about domination, it's about recognition. What about normative power? It's not about dominating.
Isn't that just about being able to swagger into the room and saying, I'm better than you are?
Is it domination? How better am I? Is the question about domination?
Yeah. And that's the question.
Yeah. Okay,
right.
That's fine.
Sorry.
Well, I was just going to say. I mean, I think it's this the same thing, right? So, what I want to dominate you, but I want you to recognize that I can, right?
Legitimate domination.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
without agreeing too hard with that. I think, so just to answer the question about regular society, international society, whatever. So when I wrote my dissertation in the concluding chapter, I wrote about how like status seeking between groups of unequal rank is very much like an academic department where the things that you might do for tenure, right? Do you want to follow the rules? And therefore get tenure, but if you feel like you're denied unjustly for some reason, you might choose to leave, you might choose to contest the rules and so on. I thought that was very clever, and then I read Steve's dissertation, which was written a few years before mine, and he made the same analogy, right? I think you did in your conclusion as well. And so in a sense, there's something deep and traumatic here that's obviously we're all working through when we work on status. But I think that, you know, like the societies that we inhabit are not, in my opinion, they're not actually that different from international society. I think there is a certain legitimation function that inheres in order. So I think about order a lot, not necessarily great power politics. And I think it's important to separate hegemony from order in that sense. And when you do that, actually critiques of hegemony can reinforce order, right? So for me, it's about the legitimation of order. It is about the rightful rule of rules, as it were, perhaps, in some sense, and who is recognized as having the privilege to shape those rules, right? I agree. I don't think it's all domination. It's certainly the way we load the dice when we think about it from a particular U.S.-centric perspective. But also, again, like from the non-West, they are the India, China, the countries that I'm interested in, they think of it as that as well. So going back to this discourse issue.
So yeah. Unfortunately, fortunately for you all, but unfortunately from the perspective of putting together a podcast, because we're on a schedule dictated by the conference program, we have to end or wrap up. But before I thank everybody, including people who came to sit up here or people who came to sit here, do you have any last, brief words of wisdom to leave with us?
Wisdom.
You should start.
We'll just go this way.
Cool.
I'll go. So, the only thing is to agree with something that Ali said just a couple minutes ago, which is that IR does have a tendency to mangle concepts from other disciplines on the way in, and it's worth trying to avoid that.
Yeah, I mean, I would agree with that I think we take a lot of assumptions about the international sphere. And for me, even though I commit the grave sin of anthropomorphizing the state, I do think the most exciting work is looking at things like practices and the ways in which actors are produced through status struggles.
So I'm going to let Ali end, which means I will speak now. And this is probably the whiskey talking as well. No, I think there's a lot of really interesting work being done in this field. It's very inspiring to see kind of the progression of questions. And so now people are asking, what are those status communities that states aspire to? How does the desire for status vary at the individual level or at the sub-state level, sub-national actors and so on? So we're really getting into exactly the things we should be getting into at this point, which is parsing out the IV even more, right? The independent variable.
I think the greatest political theorist of 20th century, Hannah Arendt, regarding status. We need to separate between power and strength. I think we are confusing a lot in status literature what is strength and strength domination and what power means and how power operates. Status is about power and there is a lot to be studied, and keep watching this fantastic space with my colleagues here. They've been producing fantastic stuff, so I stopped there.
Absolutely.
And that's it. That's the end of the episode. Thanks for listening. And remember, always read IR theory responsibly.